لبست الله
ويواشف الله النور بات الله.
So, sorry Sheikh, what about reading an ayah to the water that we are drinking or the food? For example, before starting drinking water or eating a food, for example, we started saying some invocations, religious formulas, in order to get more blessing from that food. Is it true?
You know, if we say that it has some effects on the water, uh-huh. You know, the ayat of the Quran.
Yeah. Okay.
That is something that we can say. Is true, you know, because the Holy Quran has the ayat of the Holy Quran might have this kind of, let's say, effect. On the water.
Yes.
But the point is that can we expect from that water, for example, to cure the illness, uh-huh. you know, the sickness, or to seek, for example, refuge to that water? I think that we cannot find like authentic hadith or let's say justification from the Islamic perspective that whether it is true to believe in such kind of things. I'm not
saying Bismillah before eating or for example Shukran Lillah at the end of, we can say for example the food and drinking or something, or saying Salam to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. These has their own effects, isn't it?
So Salam to Imam Hussein is okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to say Salam to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's okay, but no. If you believe that this water will solve your problem, will cure your illness, do we have any, let's say, is it something religiously or from the Sharia perspective, is it something that we can find some authentic, let's say, justification for it? And the ayat in riwayat, no, there's no such a thing, you know?
You know, there was a Japanese scientist by the name of Masaru Emoto. Mm-hmm. He was the, we can say, molecule, scientist who studied the effects of different sounds of the molecules of water. So one of them was, for example, reciting out the text of the Holy Quran to the molecules of water and how the molecules will react to the sound that they hear. Upon, for example, recitation of the Quran, the shape of the molecules was in their most beautiful parts, which is, for example, intact. You know, it is not like, for example, rock music when you play for someone, you know, it will be somehow agitated inside or agitated in the molecule. So we could see that the sounds and the in the science of the sound and the, we can say, audiography, the sounds have direct effect on the world around. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why if we bless our day or bless our food or water or the recitation of the ayah of the Quran or something like that, it will give us more spiritual perfection and growth, isn't it, Sheikh?
As I told you, it would have a kind of effect on the molecules of the water, you know?
Yes.
There's no doubt about which. But the point is that do we have any ayah, you know, any riwayah, any hadith, saying that, for example, if you read some ayat of the Quran on the water, then it will cure, you know, your sickness, your illness. There's no such thing, you know?
Yes.
Of course, it is good to read sometimes the holy ayat of the Holy Quran before, for example, drinking water, you know?
Yes.
There's no problem with that. But the point is that you should not believe in this, that this water will cure the illness. We do not have such a thing in riwayat, you know?
So everything is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We need the power.
Yes.
And the realm of the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the problems might be solved. But, Shaykh, we know that there's so many people who have been, for example, healed during the history of Islam. For example, Jesus Christ himself was a healer, isn't it? Mm. The Aimas did so, or Prophet Muhammad himself did so. Mm-hmm. So by the order of Allah and by the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, such people exist. I mean,
of course, you know, the miracles of the prophets, that is something exceptional, you know.
Yes.
We cannot generalize it for all the people. Yeah, Prophet Isa, for example, could blow into the piece of clay and make it like bird. Can we say that everybody could do that? No, of course not, you know. Or, for example, A'imma sometimes made some du'as, specific du'as, prayers. They had this power, but we cannot generalize it for the ordinary people, saying that it's allowed for all the people to blow in the clay. Nothing will happen, you know. That's that's the reality.
Yes, and we must say that we must not lose our logic or rationality in such cases, because logic and rationality is also emphasized by the religion of Islam, isn't it? For example, to lose your mind and just follow out your feelings, and we can't say get nowhere. That's all right. Okay, we got about two more minutes. Let me ask the final question regarding this part. So what religious formula do you recommend the people in order to start, for example, their eating and drinking or the finish according to Islam? Do we have any aqaid, a special aqaid on this?
You know, in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet ﷺ, we have that when the Prophet was drinking or wanted to drink, for example, a glass of water, a cup of water.
Yes.
First of all, Prophet drank it in, for example, three times, not once.
Yes.
This is very good to
do that. In three, for example, intervals.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And then he would always praise Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala before drinking, after drink.
Yes.
He did not drink water while standing.
Okay.
For example, you know. Sometimes we have these kind of things in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet that when it comes to drinking water, we can apply these sort of things. Or when it comes to the Holy Quran, why don't we read the Holy Quran for being healed, for being created, the Holy Quran itself.
Yes.
You know, because the ayat of the Holy Quran, for example, for Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
We have this in riwayat that if you put your right hand on your heart and recite, directing yourself towards Qibla with wudu.
Yes. Yes.
And then write, for example, seven times Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
On your heart.
Yes.
Then it will, for example, help you a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, these sort of things we have when it comes to the riwayat.
That's all right. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. We again do supplicate to Allah to hasten the reappearance of Imam Asr, Ajalallah, Inshallah. Fi Amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Agreements marking a significant step forward in enhancing economic relations between Iran and Armenia. 19 MOUs that lay down the framework for expanding mutually beneficial bilateral cooperation in a wide range of areas. Iran and Armenia's economic relations have consistently strengthened over the past couple of years, with bilateral trade reaching $1 billion, and now both sides are ready to take it to the next level.
For both our countries, there is great potential to boost trade, and we are adamant about using all the capacities to expand our relations. I have to note that promoting political and economic relations with Iran has been high on the agenda of the government of Armenia. We attach great importance to our relations with Iran in all fields.
This is all in line with agreements to increase bilateral trade in two phases made in 2022 during the Armenian Prime Minister's visit to Tehran.
According to the agreements made in 2022 and the first phase, we set the target for a trade volume of $1 billion. And now we are taking the necessary measures to increase that by threefold. In order to reach this objective, we are signing agreements that cover 19 areas of economic cooperation.
The recently signed Eurasia Free Trade Agreement is expected to facilitate the implementation of these MOUs by eliminating customs duties. So, we are on the right track.
These developments come at a time when Iran has been an anchor for peace, with sparks of tension every now and then between Armenia and Azerbaijan turning into an issue of concern. Therefore, in the big picture, these scenes could translate into measures that go beyond traditional rhetoric, encouraging stability in the region.
Iran and Armenia are taking practical steps to expand business and trade relations, taking their economic ties to the next level, at a time when these ties seem crucial to establish peace and security in the region. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers and the resistance forces. People from as far away as Saudi Arabia's Najran province joined the gathering.
We, the tribes and nobles of Najran, came here in response to the call by Abdul Malik al-Houthi to support the people of Gaza. We declare from Sana'a that we are with Ansarullah in standing against the Zionists and the Americans who are committing genocide in Gaza. All Arabs and Muslims must stand by Gaza as it is a religious, national and humanitarian duty.
The position of the Yemeni people is consistent with its leadership. They are all in one accord with Palestine and with the axis of resistance. It is necessary to act with one's heart and soul. People have come out today to express their position and steadfastness until Palestine is liberated.
The protesters condemned the Israeli aggression against Rafah on the border of Egypt and urged their armed forces to intensify naval operations in response to the regime's war crimes in Rafah. They expressed willingness to join the Yemeni armed forces and fight against those who commit horrible crimes against innocent civilians in Gaza.
All Yemenis, young and old, men and women, learn to use all types of weapons, from pistols to automatic rifles, anti-aircraft guns and missiles. Everyone is preparing for the decisive battle with the Zionists. When we declare that we are ready, it is not to brag in the media, but rather we are truly prepared to confront America, Israel and those with them.
Earlier, the spokesman for the Yemeni army stated that the forces had successfully targeted a British ship in the Gulf of Aden using naval missiles. He also pledged to continue preventing Israeli-linked vessels from sailing through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait until the Israeli genocide stops.
People here believe that it is time for Muslims around the world to unite against the Israeli enemy and its backers. They call on the people across the Arab world to take to the streets and initiate concrete actions against the Israeli atrocities in Gaza. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On the martyrdom anniversary of three prominent leaders, Hezbollah's Secretary General vowed that the resistance will retaliate for the Israeli strikes that killed civilians in South Lebanon, considering them deliberate massacres.
I tell friend and foe, the enemy will pay in blood for the bloodshed of our women and children in the last few days in Nabatea and Sawana and other towns of South Lebanon.
Analysts believe Nasrallah's words are very significant, but so is his deliberate silence on several issues.
This is the general approach with Sayyid Hassan always takes, trying to keep the enemy always in a state of psychological fear, not expecting or not being able to anticipate how the retaliation might come.
Hezbollah declared it launched a first retaliation for the massacres by launching Katyusha rockets against targets in Kiryat Shmona. But the leader of the resistance responded to the Israeli war minister Yoav Gallant's threats against Lebanon, saying the rocket capabilities of the Lebanese resistance goes beyond that.
Perhaps Gallant has forgotten that the resistance possesses a massive and precise missile power that enables it to strike Kiryat Shmona and all the way to Eilat.
He also underlined that the resistance front in the region as a whole has been able to enforce a balance of power, which bars the Israelis and the United States from achieving their goals.
He said that the Yemenis, in the action they took, did not resort to focusing on the Americans in their military operations, but rather continue to focus on Israel. And he said that that must remain the strategy. So I think that that's a very important. Sayyid Hassan continues to set realistic goals and to focus on weakening the Israeli side and not to go into some rash kind of action which could lead to strategically backfiring against the axis of resistance.
Hezbollah supporters commemorate yearly the martyrdom of Hezbollah's slain Secretary General Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, who was assassinated in an Israeli strike on the martyrdom anniversary of Sheikh Raghib Harb, a leader of the grassroots movement. Hezbollah is also commemorating the martyrdom of its top military commander, Imad Mughniyeh. The martyrdom of each of Hezbollah's leaders remembered today signaled a new stage in the resistance movement's development. Now, any miscalculation by the Israeli regime could be a turning point in Hezbollah's use of its covert capabilities. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Dayfullah Shami, spokesperson for the Yemeni government and Minister of Information, once again reiterated Yemen's stance that the U.S. presence in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden poses a real threat to international maritime navigation by militarizing international waters. As Shami stated that Washington's presence under the pretext of protecting Israeli vessels provokes the Yemeni army to continue its naval operations.
America is the source of real threats to navigation in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and the presence of its forces that came from a distance of 9,000 miles to launch an aggression against Yemen under false and blatant justifications. They are to protect the ships of the Israeli entity and support it economically and militarily, and have nothing to do with securing international navigation.
Hashemi added that the U.S. and U.K. have launched over 400 airstrikes against the Yemeni territories, resulting in the deaths of more than 40 soldiers. He asserted that neither Western aggression nor the U.S. designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist group will halt Yemen's naval operations in support of Palestinians.
The American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group is ironic. How can a terrorist classify those who defend themselves and their causes as terrorists? This designation shows U.S. no longer has any steps to take to stop Yemeni operations in support of Palestine. This classification will not affect Yemen's military operations, but may be a provocation for greater escalation.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that no Israeli-linked vessel has sailed through the Red Sea in the past weeks, describing this as a major victory. He accused the US and UK of being the real terrorists for assisting the Israeli regime in committing war crimes against the innocent people of the Gaza Strip.
Yemen's official stance is clear. The Yemeni army's naval operations will continue until the Israeli war against Gaza stops. Officials say the United States designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group will not help the US and UK achieve the objectives they failed to reach through military aggression.
Addressing women's health challenges and how they may affect the family, and particularly young children. Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Tajikistan, along with the WHO, coming together for the 28th time since 2005 to promote regional cooperation, an initiative by the Islamic Republic of Iran to improve public healthcare services.
Regional and sub-regional partnerships are crucial for effective implementation of joint regional initiatives and cross-border collaboration and for detecting and responding to disease outbreaks and other man-made and natural disasters.
The challenges discussed in this three-day meeting will provide the groundwork for a much larger international health conference dubbed PAC for UAC, or Primary Healthcare for Universal Health Coverage, to be held right here in March.
This is the eighth time during Mr. Raisi's term in office that the G5 meeting is held. The main objective is to pinpoint the challenges that exist so that we can plan the upcoming PAC for UHC conference. The health sector of Iran has improved to a level where it can not only become a health tourism hub, but also share its valuable experiences with regional countries and help with improving health issues.
And while neighboring countries are dealing with a number of issues, they still could not turn a blind eye to the tragic situation of mothers and children in Gaza, living in dreadful conditions, now struggling to access safe water and sanitation, a basic human right.
We want healthy mothers to give birth to healthy babies, because that is the only way we can plan for the future of our societies. In Tajikistan, recently ratified laws are in line with this policy, and I hope that all women in different parts of our region can enjoy the kind of support we have in our country.
G5 Forum basically provides us an opportunity to learn from the weaknesses, from the challenges, and take a comparative disadvantage of each other from our strengths and experiences.
The ultimate goal is to provide universal health coverage and develop national roadmaps and strategies for improving healthcare services. Iran's initiative in this regard has allowed major advancements, and according to the World Health Organization, the Islamic Republic of Iran is now a role model, with its PAC, or primary healthcare network, extending beyond its borders.
These meetings will continue until February 15th, with the participants discussing the different challenges that they're facing, also paving the way for an international health conference that will be held in the Iranian capital in March. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Islamic Resistance Movement has announced that it conducted a new batch of operations, with the count over 1,000. The hits recently include the targeting and destruction of espionage and technical devices in the radar post, which is situated in the occupied Lebanese Shabah farms. We can see the occupied Lebanese Shabah farms, where all military Israeli posts have been targeted and its hardware destroyed. Just beneath that, we can see the town of Al-Khiyam, which is subject to almost daily Israeli shelling. The resistance also declared it has used the heavy Falak 1 rocket to target the Ma'ali Golan barracks, while also targeting the Kila post in the occupied Golan Heights in retaliation for Israel's aggressions in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Several secret headquarters, including the 91st Division in the Galilee region, and gatherings of soldiers were also under Hezbollah's fire. Experts believe the confrontation is moving in an ascending ladder of events.
The Israelis are attempting to put pressure on the resistance by changing the rules of engagement, and therefore have begun with targeted assassinations. The resistance is responding in accordance with its vision of this battle, and is ensuring that it remains limited to the border region where it has the upper hand.
Journalists and cameramen are always on high alert in case sounds of explosions are heard to get some glimpse of a battle which seems unpredictable. Yet as Israelis go further, so will the resistance. Sheikh Jihad Asadi is a resident of the southern town of Shabah, but was forced to live further away from his town, which has been partially occupied by the Israelis since after the 1967 war. He says he keeps an eye on the Shabah farms to watch resistance rockets hit their targets and believes it will one day be liberated.
Netanyahu says he will withdraw from Shabah farms if Hezbollah withdraws to the north of the Latani River. We tell him that it is he who has to withdraw from occupied Lebanese land. This is the beginning of the end of the Israeli regime, and we advise all the Zionist settlers not to remain on our land, even if a truce is in place.
Hezbollah has also targeted several Israeli drones and lately hacked and confiscated an Israeli Skylark drone. With the scope of Israeli attacks amplifying, Hezbollah is flexibly adhering to the needs of the battlefield, whether in the quality or the quantity of their hits against Israeli targets or the armaments used. Maryam Saleh from Khiyam, South Lebanon.
An emergency protest outside the UK Prime Minister's office to try and stop an imminent massacre, called for by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a coalition of other similar organizations.
Week after week, pro-Palestinian protesters have come out in huge numbers to demand that the British government call for a permanent, immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and to terminate its military and political support for apartheid Israel. And they're galvanized by the knowledge and hope that the pressure they're ramping up on the British government will eventually stir action.
In a sign of that pressure working, only hours before the protests, the UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron joined other European leaders to caution the Netanyahu regime to think twice about its mass incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which shelters 1.4 million displaced Palestinians.
We are very concerned about the situation and we want Israel to stop and think very seriously before it takes any further action. But above all, what we want is an immediate pause in the fighting. And we want that pause to lead to a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire, without a return to further fighting.
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
But while that may seem like a change in the UK government's tone, the protesters here say it doesn't go far enough.
What kind of disturbed and dystopian world are we in? We're asking for peace is become slander. I just do not understand. I cannot comprehend what more needs to be done. Do they need to see 1 million Gazans being exterminated on their TVs or drowning in the Mediterranean Sea? Because that is the options that Israel is giving them.
Another demand here, an end to UK arms sales to Israel. According to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, between 2015 and 2022, the UK licensed more than $500 million worth of weapons to Tel Aviv. Saeed Purizab, London.
It's a day off for Zayed, a computer science student in New Delhi, hailing from neighboring Uttar Pradesh state. He wants to pursue a career in New Delhi, saying finding job is like a battle in this part of the world. But he is disappointed with the fact that elections are due and nothing more is important for politicians rather than stoking religious sentiments.
The governments have their own agendas to stay in power and they want to win over and over again. So the easy tool is to exploit people on the issue of faith. India's people from all faiths and the politicians want us to stay uneducated. So we won't question them on their policies. We should be talking about education, unemployment, healthcare, and good future for our next generation.
After the opening of a major Hindu temple in the town of Ayodhya last month, anti-Muslim sentiments are running high in India. In the Himalayan state of Uttarakhand, the demolition of a decades-old mosque and its seminary has led to deadly clashes. The violence is the latest incident of communal flare-up ahead of general elections. Muslim sites have become a new target of the right-wing Hindu groups. In recent weeks, top Muslim leaders urged the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to end the religious dispute, citing a threat to communal harmony and calling for the protection of Muslim places of worship.
Since the BJP rule started in 2014, they are doing everything to destroy the country's secular credential. They are taking the country in the wrong direction by promoting Hindu first agenda to patronize the majority. But this country has a constitution which we trust and believe in. They raised a mosque in New Delhi last week, now in Haldwani, calling them illegal encroachment despite the fact they are decades old. They are selectively targeting a particular community, which is very unfortunate.
Experts say the demolitions are not confined to any particular region or state, but a deliberate attempt to demonize the Muslim community. Meanwhile, tensions have gripped the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh, Bareilly city, after the arrest of an Islamic cleric who had called for protests against the demolition of the mosque. Human rights groups have called on the Indian government to halt this bulldozer campaign. Critics accuse the Modi's government of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege the ruling party is stigmatizing its critics and adopting policies that legitimize violence against the religious minorities. The BJP denies the claims, saying equal rights for all is enshrined in Indian democracy.
General elections in India are due in May 2024. Observers say many polarizing issues, including those related to Muslims, are being hyped in both social and political domain to garner public attention in the Hindu-majority India, where religion is used for electoral gains. Rights groups have accused the ruling BJP of selectively targeting Muslims, their homes, places of worship and businesses, calling it a larger political agenda. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Liberal Democrats say last month an average of 5,735 people a day faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in accidents and emergency departments in hospitals. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than 1.5 million patients in England had to wait 12 hours or longer in accidents and emergency departments in the past year, according to figures that MPs say lay bare the impact of the government's neglect of the National Health Service. Last month, 177,805 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in emergency departments, an average of 5,735 a day. It means 1 in 10 patients, or 12.4% of patients arriving at accidents in emergency departments, waited 12 hours before being admitted, transferred or discharged. In total, between February of 2023 and January of 2024, 1,540,945 patients experienced long waits, according to analysis of official data by the Liberal Democrats. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments, waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need, according to Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson. Daisy Cooper added, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service." January was the worst month in the past year as winter pressures struck. In some hospitals, 1 in 4 patients faced delays of 12 hours or more. One 88-year-old woman was left waiting 16 hours, according to the Liberal Democrats. The analysis showed the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency departments after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. The figures are separate from last week's published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospitals soared to 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This was the second highest figure on record, just below 54,573 in December of 2022. The number of people who waited at least 4 hours from the decision to admission also grew from 148,282 in December to 158,721 last month. Again, the second highest figure on record. Long waits at accidents and emergency departments have been linked to serious patient harm. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously highlighted data showing that once people wait more than about 6 hours and need to be admitted into hospital, their risk of dying starts to increase. Daisy Cooper said, "Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and vulnerable people. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas, this unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm. It's time Conservative ministers started taking this National Health Service crisis seriously, instead of ignoring all the warning signs while patients are suffering." The Department of Health and Social Care said accidents and emergency performance was improving despite winter pressures and the highest number of January accidents and emergency attendances on record. "We're determined to continue improving patient care, having already delivered on our promise to create 5,000 extra permanent hospital beds and 10,000 hospital at home beds, freeing up capacity and cutting waiting times," according to a spokesperson. British newspaper The Nottingham Post has also covered this story. More than 1,000 people were stuck waiting for over 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments in Nottinghamshire last month. The latest data from the National Health Service has shown a dramatic increase in patients experiencing a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency departments in January over the last 8 years. A total of 900 patients at Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust and 224 patients at Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency in January, according to the latest data from the National Health Service. That's up from 855 last January at Nottingham University Hospital's and 289 at Sherwood Forest Hospitals. In January of 2022, there were 514 and 40 at the two respective hospitals who had to wait over 12 hours to be admitted. Back in January of 2019, there were none at either NHS Trust, nor in January of 2018, while in 2017, there were just two patients at Nottingham University Hospitals. Nationally, a total of 54,308 patients had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency this January. This is the second highest number on record, behind only December of 2022, when 54,573 people had to wait over 12 hours. The Liberal Democrat website has also covered this story and tells us more. A staggering 1.5 million patients in England waited 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments over the past year, new analysis by the Liberal Democrats has revealed. The figures reveal the true scale of the accidents and emergency delays over a 12-month period for the first time. Shockingly, at some NHS trusts, over 1 in 4 patients are facing delays of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments. The Liberal Democrats said it showed that 12-hour delays had become almost the norm in some areas of England. The previously hidden data from NHS England shows the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. These figures are separate from the regularly published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The latest figures show that in total, 1,540,945 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency between February of 2023, when the new data was first published, to January of 2024. This equates to almost 1 in 10 or 9.6% of patients during that period, 5 times higher than the National Health Service requirement that no more than 2% of patients should wait 12 hours or more. Shockingly, it means an average of over 4,200 patients waited over 12 hours at accidents and emergency departments every day over the past year. January saw the worst figures yet as winter pressure stuck, with a record 177,805 or 1 in 8 patients, that is 12.4%, facing accidents and emergency waits of over 12 hours. At Blackpool Teaching Hospitals, over 1 in 4 patients in January faced accidents and emergency delays of 12 hours or more, the worst in the country. This was followed by Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital with 25.4%. Research from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously estimated that for every 82 admitted patients whose transfer to a hospital bed is delayed beyond 6 to 8 hours from arrival, there is one extra death. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Daisy Cooper MP said, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need. Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and the vulnerable. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas these unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm."
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to appoint.
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us.
Today's tip: what are the secrets of the eyes, the heart, and our ubudiyyah? Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. So, dear listeners, we are talking about the secrets of the eyes, the heart, and ubudiyyah. So, of course, this ubudiyyah, this worship, this servitude, this obedience to the Almighty Allah, this is something that is not just done via our physical body, but it is also done via our heart and our soul and our ruh, our spirit. Now, this heart is also in many different traditions and in many of the different teachings of the Urafa, the spiritual wayfarers on the path towards the nearness and the qurba of the Almighty Allah. This heart has been, you know, kind of said to be the center of a human being. And sometimes it is used interchangeably. So sometimes the ruh, the soul, or the spirit is also known as the heart. But this idea of the heart itself, of course, is a very complex and a very profound, you know, statement. Sometimes it is said that it is connected with the emotions of an individual. But regardless, this is an aspect of a human being, the heart. And of course, in the traditions, we find that it is said that the heart is the home of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So do not place anyone other than Allah in this heart of yours. So this heart, of course, is a very special aspect of a human being. And these are just some of the mysteries of the essence and this complete composition, which is known as a human body. But definitely we're not talking about the physical heart that pumps blood, you know, for our whole lives. This is more like this emotional a center, if you will, or, for example, it is the center of the soul, if you will. Again, these are discussions that are quite complex and profound. But this heart, you know, is where the love of Allah resides in. And this is what's really important. This ishq, this profound love that an individual has. Now, this love can be towards material things, it can be towards worldly things, it can be towards, you know, wealth or position or power, all things which are really inconsequential and have no true intrinsic value, because all of these things will remain here upon this earth. And so the real love and the real ishq, the real profound and unimaginable and deep love that an individual must have is towards Allah. And this love emanates from the heart, right? And this is something that even if we come out of the very, you know, mystical and spiritual realm, everybody, you know, they know that the heart is the one that loves another, right? So they say, I love you, my heart loves you. When you send a love letter to somebody, you send them a heart, you know? Or when your heart breaks, for example, you make that little heart with a little crack in the middle, right? So everybody pretty much knows Urfan, and in the common, you know, parlance and understanding of the people, that the heart is this aspect where the love is based upon it.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Regulations are a natural part of life. You notice that laws are made to ensure freedom. Laws are made to ensure progression. Laws are made to ensure that the society does not self-destruct. And what better law than divine law, which covers not only our practical applications day to day, but it fulfills the mission of our existence. And one of those laws that the Quran has established is the dietary rules, because we always say you are what you eat. And there is no question that if you ask any dietitian, anybody who understands the nature of food, that if you want to live a healthy life, make sure you selectively choose the kind of food that you should put in your body, because ultimately that will affect the longevity of one's existence. And the Quran not only addresses that part, but also is concerned about the happiness and tranquility that we possess as a result of eating. So eating good food is a fundamental principle in Islam, halalan, we say rizqan tayyiba, meaning pure food, good food, chosen food, not anything that crawls in, anything that can be edible that should be put in one's mouth. And God warned that there are certain poisons out there that creatures have been created simply to absorb the filth of society. And it would be foolish if we were to now imbibe and eat those kinds of creatures, because then it would be double trouble. Hence pork, which is the flesh of swine, which has been systematically forbidden for all of human being, all human beings. If you look at the Abrahamic laws, including the Old Testament and the New, you find that the consumption of the flesh of swine is forbidden. And Islam is very strict about that. And if you examine the collective nature of our appreciation for choosing the kind of food we eat, we are its beneficiaries ultimately. And I think that's the beauty of a religion that goes to that level, not only telling me to be a good person and to promote good and forbid evil, but also shows me how to do it and how to be happy when I promote good and forbid evil. I think that's a complete system.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So in continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that the heart is the resting place of love, and that this love should only be for the Almighty Allah, the love for those whom the Almighty Allah has commanded us to love, keeping in mind that that secondary or tertiary love should not take precedence over our fundamental and primary love, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So you must be wondering by now, well, we talked about the heart, but we were talking, and the point of the program, the subject was the eyes, the heart, and of course, ubudiyya. So we kind of went out of order, but I think it's okay. So we talked about the heart and how this is the resting place of the love of Allah, or in other traditions, it is the home of Allah, right? I mean, if you love Allah, then this will be Allah's home. If you don't love Allah, then why would it be Allah's home? Now, the heart, when it loves someone, when it loves something, then it is attached to that something and it becomes subservient to that something. And when you become subservient to that something, then that is what is known as ubudiyya, right? The servitude, the obedience, and the worship to, in our case, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so when our heart is connected to something, attached to something, becomes subservient to something, then it naturally goes into this state of ubudiyya. Now, for lack of a better terminology, we have the story of Romeo and Juliet, you know, in the British English literature. You know, these two people who were technically subservient to one another because of their love for one another. You know, in the Persian literature, we have Layla and Majnun, you know, these two individuals who also are subservient to one another because of this love that is occurring between the two of them. So now we know the connection between the heart and what it is attached to, and ubudiyya, the servitude and the worship and the obedience to something, whatever that may be. But what about the eyes? Now, this is very interesting, and we're going to have to try to wrap it up quickly, is the idea that the eyes are the gate or the keys to the soul or the keys to the heart. Whatever you gaze upon, if you gaze upon it for long enough, you know, eventually it has a connection directly with your heart. And this is very important, and I will leave the rest of the reflection and contemplation to our dear esteemed listeners. So when you look at nature, you think of Allah. That establishes a connection with Allah. When you look at the Quran, right? When you think about the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, or you read the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, right? Or you go and you look at a masjid, or you look at the prayer mat, right? All of these things that you're looking at are establishing a direct connection with your heart and in turn with ubudiyya. But God forbid, and may Allah forgive all of us, if for whatever reason we are gazing upon things which are haram, right? We are gazing upon non-mahram. We are gazing upon, you know, the various images that we run across. And they don't have to be completely 100%, you know, out there bad images, you know. And I think everybody knows what I'm, these kind of X-rated images. No, even an image of a woman, you know, in a model that is wearing clothes, but it is haram, it is non-mahram. These things start to establish a connection and a connection, yes, in our heart towards that thing, and then slowly but surely we end up becoming a abid, a worshiper or subservient to that thing. So the eyes are the keys to the heart, and the heart is the key to ubudiyya. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. الذي أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces intensify attacks on hospitals and vital medical facilities as the regime's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip.